practices for a special meeting, February 13th, 2018. Welcome to everybody, board members, staff, and public. Patricia, would you like to do the safety briefing, please?
Sure. Good morning, welcome to the Natural Resources Building. In the event of an emergency, the alarms may sound and flash. In the event of a earthquake, please drop to the floor, cover your head as best as you can. Board members, please go under the table and cover your head. In any evacuation, staff will lead you out the double doors in the front of the room and along the building out to Jefferson Street. There, staff is equipped to treat any injuries or help you with relocating and checking in. At this time, please silence any noise-making devices you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. So one of the first things I want to do is introduce Jeff Davis. Jeff comes to us from the new designee from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, replacing Joe Storr.
Super excited. This is my first official meeting.
All right. One other little piece of business I want to take care of, because I understand the person will be here tomorrow. Todd Baldwin, can you come up, please? And you can get them closer. So I understand that you're done with your SEMR co-chair duties.
Yeah, well, on to different co-chair duties.
Well, we want to make sure that you get recognized for your 4.5 years as co-chair, and we appreciate the work you've done. Okay. And to celebrate that, and presumably with this plaque.
Oh, very good.
So thank you. Okay. Today's meeting is a special meeting of the board, which will feature a workshop to hear about the science panel and their recommendations on potential habitat breaks. The board will hear how the science panel followed the board's directions from the August 2017 meeting. Any actions taken by the board will occur at tomorrow's regular board meeting. The board will also hear public comments today on the science panel's work. And then, of course, we will provide time for the board to discuss the science panel after that and make sure that we understand all the information that's been you've read and you've been presented. Other things that are on the agenda today, once we've done that, include we're going to finally hear about the compliance monitoring report from 2014 and 15, and the subsequent ISPR review of how we are now doing sampling in the compliance monitoring program. There's going to be an update from the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee. As requested, I got somebody from the wildfire program coming down to give us an overview of the 20-year forest health plan. And the geology division is coming in, now known as the Washington Geological Survey, to also, as requested by the board, to talk about the status of LIDAR acquisition, landslide mapping in the database, and the web portal we have. And then we'll have the board members request, we can talk about any staff reports, and then we will have an executive session at the end of the day. So, what I'd like to do is call up the science panel. Let's start.
Did you want to do board introduction?
Oh, thank you, board member Lori. Getting ahead of myself. Board Member Herrera, would you like to kick that off?
Good morning. I'm David Herrera. I'm a general public member of the Forest Practices Board.
Carmen Smith, contract waters representative.
Good morning, everyone. Tom Laurie, Acala.
Good morning, Tom Nelson. I'm a public member.
Good morning, Heather Ballers, Washington State Department of Commerce. Good morning, Paula Sweeney, disorganized and harried member of the general public.
Who's their sunshine today? Stephen Bernath, board designee, chair designee of National Public Lands.
Jeff Davis, Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Brent Davis, general public.
Patrick Aber, director designee for the Department of Agriculture.
Morning, Noel Willett, timber products union representative.
Hello, Bob Gunther. I represent the small landowners and I'm a public member.
Good morning, Lisa Janicki, representing the counties.
Staff.
Trish Anderson, Forest Practices Board Rules Coordinator.
Good morning, Mark Engel, DNR Assistant Division Manager, Forest Practices.
Bill Ferrister, Senior Counsel, Attorney General's Office.
And Joe Schramick, DNR Forest Practices Division Manager.
Okay, thank you. So, Alan, you want to put up? You can bring some more chairs up. How are we going to do this?
We'll start with presentation.
Okay.
And then the rest of the panel will come up with the second part.
Oh, okay. So as you will recall, the board delayed approval on elements defining potential habitat breaks into a more geographically representative data set to be assembled and analyzed by the expert science panel for their consideration of the appropriate criteria to establish PHBs. The board directed the AMPA, Hans Burge, to work with the science panel and DNR to collect and evaluate data that was geographically representative of Washington to determine the PHB criteria. Hans and members of the panel will identify how the data was collected, QAQC done with the data, and analysis performed to provide the board with recommendations. The panel will provide the board with, I hope, some ideas on trade-offs between the different recommendations you put forward and the status of the study design for the validation of the study.
Good morning, Chair Bernath, members of the board. My name is Hans Burge. I'm the Adaptive Management Program Administrator.
Good morning. I'm Phil Roney with Permafish Sciences. I'm the chair of the science panel.
We'll be presenting to you today on the work that we've been doing for the potential habitat break. The format of the presentation is I'm going to give the background introduction and then Dr. Roney will take over from there. This presentation is entitled The Review and Recommendations for Potential Fish Habitat Breaks, Begin Protocol Surveys to Determine End of Fish Habitat on State and Private Forest Lands to Washington State. I think it's really important to emphasize it is the point to begin the protocol surveys. Okay, so the outline of our presentation, we're going to briefly go through some background, including the board motions. Then we'll discuss the science panel process, findings, and recommendations. Just as a way of reminder, the Type F recommendations from policy to the board, which you received in May of 2017, included following the dispute resolution process, the board adopted items in consensus from policy and included the maps. There were majority and minority reports for off-channel habitat that were presented. And then there was a recommendation from policy that the board adopt the FHAM framework, Fish Habitat Assessment Methodology Framework, and work on identifying the PHB, potential fish, potential habitat criteria, which including there were primary and secondary considerations. The primary were permanent natural barriers, gradient, stream width, basin size, channel size, interaction of size and gradient, and stream morphology. Secondary characteristics were water quantity, substrate, water quality, primary production as a surrogate for food, and temporal considerations. Temporal considerations meaning the permanence of the decision about FN breaks and how fish use may change over time in those locations. Just as a reminder, a potential habitat break is not necessarily the FN break. We can't emphasize this enough. Secondly, it's the first point of a potentially unfavorable habitat upstream from the last known fish, which is the end of fish or EOF, and the starting point for a protocol survey. Again, it's the point to initiate a protocol electrofishing survey. So just quick reminder, there were board motions that were passed in the May 2017 meeting, and I'm just gonna touch on these real quickly. The first one was for the YAMPA to convene a lead and lead a group of internal and external science technical experts to work under the direction of the board, consultation with policy, caucuses to identify those team members, so the internal piece of that. The second is the board directs the group of internal and external science technical experts to determine those elements that would constitute a barrier and or potential habitat break. The group is directed to review the FHAM listed habitat break features for combinations of primary and secondary features to determine those physical, biological, and chemical elements that would individually or in combination constitute a high probability the PHB is coincident with a significant change in habitat, including stream size, stream gradient, the interaction of size and gradient, and the presence of barriers that limit accessibility. Thus, the appropriate point to initiate a protocol survey. The last one, the Forest Practices Board, directed that these recommendations would be brought to the August 2017 meeting, and the recommendations need to include the metrics to identify the PHBs and a plan for the validation. So that resulted in the science panel part one process. Again, it was a short timeline. There was a call for data on the 15th of May, immediately following the board meeting, and it was following the testimony that was provided to the board at the May meeting. There was formation of the science panel that accomplished some of the pieces of the motions there. There was meetings that occurred with stakeholder technical groups, some data analysis that was done, recommendations were shared with stakeholders, report to the board, and then the subsequent presentation to accomplish the board motions for May. So then we went through the August 2017 board meeting, and the motions that were passed, the board determined to delay the approval of the PHB recommendations until February. The action would provide time to gather and analyze Eastern Washington data, provide transparency by daylighting the data in QAQC used to provide data to the science panel, and to build an understanding around the PHB report. It also directed the AMPA, myself, to work with the WFPA to provide documentation of how data were selected and provide to the science panel by the 20th of September 2017. And it included working with the science panel to add an addendum that includes documentation from WFPA and others who provided data and published the data used in the analyses to determine the recommendation of PHBs. So then the second motion was to direct the AMPA to facilitate the gathering of data for Eastern Washington and those areas of Western Washington not represented currently, and work with the science technical expert panel to incorporate these data into their analysis to determine PHBs. It included working with the panel to identify QAQC criteria for the data, coordinate the compilation of the data from a random sample of existing approved WTMFs, water type modification forms, or other appropriate sources of data. All stakeholders were invited to participate in the collation of data. The panel will report the progress on collecting data at the November 2017 board meeting. The third was to validate the original analysis that resulted in the recommendations in the PHB report to the board, again from August. Included facilitating the gathering of a random sample approved of Western Washington water types, ponds, and work with the expert panel to analyze the data and compare the results to those of the original analyses. And that was to be included in the February report. The last motion related here was to work with the panel to develop the validation study and complete ISPR review of the study by the February 2018 meeting. The study will be completed within two field seasons, reported to the board in the next prior to the next field season. And then the last piece wasn't a board motion, but it was a communication that the board had directly with me at the meeting. And it agreed that I would work with the panel to have additional meetings with the stakeholder technical group to invite input and hear operational perspective on the analysis and the results as the panel prepares recommendations to the board. And real quickly, we did gather a representative sample of water type mods for FM breaks statewide. We attempted to do that by ecoregion. There's some challenges there, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. We invited stakeholder participation in the data mining from the WTMFs. There was QAQC of the potential data that we used. We published the data that were used in the analysis on the board's website, so it's freely available to the public. We communicated the process to stakeholders in many different ways. Meetings, conference calls, an open invitation to ask questions of the panel, memos from the Forest Practices Division Manager, updates at policy, soliciting written feedback, and then of course the draft report review. Following the analysis, we came up with different recommendations. Those are in the report. We'll talk about those later. We compared the analysis with the original landowner data. That was part of motion three, and the tables are also in the report. And the WFPA did present their QAQC methodology, what they used from data selection. The first go around to the board in November, those data weren't published, but they were, those results were communicated to the board. And the validation study, I reported to the board at your November meeting that the validation study design would be delayed until May, and it would be following the review at ISPR. And that's still an update for me.
So I'm going to go through our process and recommendations. Just to remind you of, okay, just to remind you what the goal was, which was to develop recommendations for the definition of PHPs. So the PHPs are the points to initiate a protocol survey, and the reason we keep emphasizing that is we have continued to get comments that indicate that some people think that it is the FN break. And it is the first point of potentially unfavorable habitat upstream from last known fish, and the starting point for protocol survey. Okay, I think we've established that I do not know how to use this mouse. All right, so science panel is made up of a group of experts with expertise in fish biology, geomorphology, fish habitat, and forestry relationships, water typing, aquatic ecology, statistics and spatial analysis, and fish habitat research. There are 9 members of the science panel, including myself. Kai Ross, Jeff Kirshner, Pat Trotter, Ray Tim, Pete Bisson, Brian France, and Joe Maroney, as well as Hans. We have several people on the panel that have more than 30 years of experience. I think collectively it's something ridiculous like 200 years of combined experience. Of course, nobody's 200 years old on the panel, unfortunately. So the process for doing this, we really used 3 main pieces of information. The literature and available science and latest science, data and the data analysis, which we're going to talk about, and professional opinion and experience.
So the first part of that is really we reviewed the existing data and science to determine what the PHB criteria should include or what the key criteria are. We then came up with some ideas of different potential criteria. We collected data to test those. So we had data on the end of fish and end of fish habitat from existing water type modification forms to test some of the different criteria. And then based on professional opinion, our experience, talking with others who've done, I think it's 70 or 80% of the water type modification protocol surveys and water type modification forms throughout the state to come up with some recommendations. So we also, as Tom's indicated, we got input from the stakeholders along the way. And we obviously produced a report, which you all, I'm sure, seen. So let's talk about the review of the science. So the criteria that the criteria for PHBs need to be useful, simple to understand, something that's repeatable, can consistently be identified in the field, that are and accurately reflect the boundaries of the fish habitat. So when we went through the literature on this, and they also they should be supported by the scientific literature and science. So we went through the literature on this, and there are a lot of other potential criteria related to water quality or geomorphology or fish habitat, but the reality is the only ones that meet these criteria that we have above are gradient, width, and barriers or obstacles. So we then, as I said, we discussed different potential criteria, but we also we needed some data to examine those again. So we went through this data collection process. Now you know that the history here of how we had some initial calls for data last summer and our initial recommendations, and we were asked to go back to draw a random sample from the water type modification forms and get a more random sample that was distributed across different ecoregions in the state. So we went to the water type modification form through the data collection. We basically took a random sample from the different ecoregions across the state. So there are 9, I believe these are level 3 ecoregions, level 4 ecoregions. There are 9 level 4 ecoregions in the state. Two of those, well, one of them is the Central Columbia Basin, which is not forested. Another one is a small part of it comes into the state, which is the Willamette, and there were no water type modification forms in that particular ecoregion. So we had 7 ecoregions. We took a random sample of the water type modification points for each of those ecoregions with a target of 50 to 75 points per ecoregion for each metric. Now the reason we have 50 or 75 for each metric is not every water type modification form and point reports gradient, channel width, and barriers, quantitative information on those. So we use what was called a consecutive sampling, because what happens here is a water type modification form can have many points on it. So we wouldn't, we had a random selection of the points. A person would go to the actual form, find that point, and see if there was the correct information in it. So it wasn't taking a water type modification form, which might have 10 points in it across the landscape, and entering all 10 of those. That's not a random sample. However, the problem is that many of the points don't contain useful data. So we have this consecutive sample. So if they go to the form, they go to the point, it's not good data, there's another sample drawn. So we focused on Eastern Washington first, as we were directed, and then we moved to Western Washington. The data entry was done by DNR staff, some technicians from my office, as well as stakeholders that volunteered to do this. And we had actual training and feedback for everyone that was involved in the data collection. It's actually a fairly It's a fairly intensive process to go through these things. They're all on PDF, so somebody has to look through the physical form and enter the information.
What numbers do you need?
Sorry, I just had a quick question. Can you just give a really concrete example of a data form that had the information that you needed compared to one that didn't? What would cause you to toss out a form that didn't have the information that you were looking for?
Yeah, I was gonna get to that, but I'll just take it. No, I can take it right now. So the things that some of the forms, something as simple as they weren't legible. The data were not many of the forms. So there were something like 20,000 points or in the 29,000 in the database. A lot of these are not concurred upon. They're not protocol surveys. So you go to a form and it turned out, oh, this was it was supposed to be a non-fish bearing stream. They found fish on that particular spot. The landowner didn't care beyond that, so they didn't do anything else. But more typical, what it was is that the information wasn't there in terms of it. When the first one was, it wasn't legible, or it didn't have the actual measurements. So those were things that I know there's a few others.
Just didn't have the measurements.
They just didn't have the measurements. So I'll show you the next slide. Will give you an indication of kind of how many, what percentage of the forms actually had useful information. So this is the different ecoregions that we were able to get through in the time allotted. And what you have is that the forms that had useful information or a point that had useful information, the numbers, so the ones where it says yes, that was useful information, where it's no, that means no, there wasn't useful information. And then just the total number that we looked at. So what ended up happening in most of the, in all of the Eastern Washington ecoregions, to meet our sample sizes, we went through not just the random sample, but all potential points that might have data. Unfortunately, in the Blue Mountains, that only meant that there was one that we had suitable data from. So you can see the samples, the number that we found for each of those other two Eastern Washington ecoregions. Then we move over into the Western Washington, and there's a lot more data there. We only got partway through Western Washington, so there's two ecoregions that we didn't get to because we ran out of time, and that would be the Puget Sound lowlands and then the coast. This is just a distribution of these points across the landscape, and you can see the white dots are where the random points were drawn from, what it was drawn from those water type modification forms. The kind of red ones, which they look really bright on our screen here, they're a little bit washed out on your screen. Those were the original points from the landowner data set. And then you see some other points that are kind of, they say added random landowner points, which are in blue. Missing from these, so we didn't have time to collect random points in the coastal ecoregion and the Puget Sound lowlands. So what we did is we took a random sample from the landowner data set for those two ecoregions and added those to our data set for the analysis and comparing different options for criteria for PHBs. So one of the things we did was look at the data, and this will explain why we felt comfortable taking a random sample from the landowner data set for those two ecoregions in Western Washington we didn't have data. So what these are is a series of I think the formal name is kernel density plots. They're basically smooth histograms with the distribution of the points. So one of the things we did was to look at the distribution of the data to see. Ideally, what we wanted to do was do this by ecoregion. So those seven different ecoregions that were forested and we have points from, we originally wanted to do this by ecoregion, but really there wasn't enough data for each ecoregion to do this. So we went by Eastern Washington versus Western Washington. And the first thing we wanted to know is, hey, do these criteria really differ in Eastern Washington versus Western Washington from the data that we were able to get from the water type modification forms? So these are, this is wetted with, I have a bunch of different combinations, and the reason why we looked at, I have these four panels, is because
there's different ways we talked about the criteria to look at the for example, the wetted width in different ways. We looked at the upstream wetted width, the downstream wetted width, the differences in wetted widths upstream and downstream from a potential habitat break, or the ratio. Some of the criteria look at a ratio or a proportion of the upstream and downstream width. So we looked at all these to see, okay, how do these data, how are they distributed, and should we be separating by ecoregion, or should they all be combined? So oddly enough, on my screen, these things are slightly different colors than yours. So let's just focus first on east versus west side. And that's really what we, you'll notice the west is kind of, it overlaps a lot with the landowner data set. But the eastern Washington has a different distribution. And you'll see that in the different ways that we cut this, sliced up the wetted width, that there's clearly some differences in the data set between eastern and western Washington. And the landowner data set, the data set we used in the previous analysis, looks pretty similar to our random sample from western Washington. And that's why we were comfortable taking a random sample of the points in the landowner data set to fill in the couple ecoregions in western Washington that we did not have data for. This is looking at, this is gradient. So the other thing we looked at was obviously gradient. You can see the distribution. And for some of these, it's the same picture. It's quite a bit different. For the ratio, they all look fairly similar. But again, this is just kind of demonstrate how we went through and looked at the data to see how we should be slicing them up and how they compare to the previous data set that we had used. And then this is just looking at gradient. This is actually the barrier height change, but this was one of the metrics we were looking at what had to do with the change in the elevation for a non-vertical barrier, a chute or something, over upstream channel width. So we wanted to see how that was distributed. When we looked at the different barrier criteria, they're pretty similar in the three different data sets. And you'll see that borne out in our recommendations, which is pretty much a standard across the state for criteria for PHBs for barriers. So we took those data and we had these 15 potential definitions of PHBs, the same ones that we looked at in the previous report, definitions for gradient and width. And we compared those to the data set to see how if we apply those to the data set, how many of those incurred upon breaks would be successfully identified by the criteria that we used. We also looked at seven different criteria for non-vertical barriers. I don't have vertical barriers up here because we determined what we thought was appropriate for vertical barriers based largely on the literature. So just to give you an idea of how this analysis kind of goes about, the criteria we are proposing are an either or. So you either have to, in this example, so what this is just this is just plotted the different points, the gradient upstream and the upstream channel width. So if those were two criteria, how many of the points that we have that we randomly selected would meet these criteria? So in other words, if we use those criteria, these points would be they would work for that. So what you see is that the little gray area is all the points that were either where the channel width was greater, or the channel, excuse me, those are all the points that wouldn't be captured by this. So those would be outside of it. All the other ones in this other area here would be captured by that, or would be positive. So that suggests to us that you can look at this and see, well, geez, that's about 90% of the cases those criteria were successful. So that's how we looked at these criteria, and that's what this number here, you see that the percent of points that were captured by those criteria, that's what this means right here along that axis. So we looked at 15 different criteria. What I have up here is the four best performing, and the four that we recommend. And I'll just go through the first one. So this was an upstream threshold of 10%. So once you hit 10% gradient, that's a potential habitat break. If you get less than 2 feet channel width, that's a potential habitat break. And so that in these are for Western Washington, that captured 96% of the points. Now these other ones captured a somewhat lower percentage of the points and were kind of similar things, you know, a 15% threshold of gradient or a 3% channel width, and then a few other combinations. The reason that we recommended more than one is partly because we're not, you know, trying to determine the statistical significance between 92 and 96% or 91 and 96% is not probably realistic. We didn't think that those were probably statistically different. The other factor, there's about some other reasons a little bit by why we had more than one recommendation, but that's one of the major ones. For Eastern Washington, we had two out of the 15 different ones we tested. We had two that we recommended. Again, one of them was 10% upstream gradient and a 10% bank full width, or excuse me, 2 foot bank full width. And that one captured 79% of the water type modification form points, the concurred upon points. And then the other one, which was a 15% gradient and a 3 foot bank full width, captured 73%. We thought that those were the two best. Again, we weren't sure that there was a difference between 73 and 79. The other thing I wanted to point out, there's another one that was a ratio of the upstream to downstream gradient and a ratio of the bank full widths, which captured 73% as well. But the panel in general was not comfortable with recommending that one because we didn't think that it was really going to be feasible to be out there in the field trying to calculate the proportions of the different gradient and channel width. So when it came to barriers, first of all, I should say for vertical barriers, vertical drops, waterfalls, we looked at the literature. We did some analysis to look at fish jumping performance at different barrier heights. And for fish in headwater streams, and these are generally small resident fish, less than a couple hundred millimeters or less than 10 inches, a 3 foot drop, vertical drop, is generally an obstacle for migration. So our recommendation for vertical barriers is 3 feet. Now, non-vertical barriers is we did most of our analysis, because those are things like chutes and cascades and areas that are much more harder to determine than just a sheer waterfall. So we looked at, I think it was 7 different combinations for non-vertical barriers for these chutes and cascades and those type of things. And we recommended that we tested this against the data that we had, and we did east versus west side, and you'll see that on the east side, for a 20%, a gradient of 20% over one bank full channel width. And one of the big challenges here is what distance you measure the gradient over for these non-vertical barriers. That one captured 91% of the points on the east side and 83% on the west side, and that's the one we recommended. There was another criteria that performed a little bit better, which was a 20% gradient over that elevation change over 5 feet. And we just didn't think that was really feasible or a good way to go. We thought it was really better to go with it based on the gradient over a set number of channel widths, bank full widths, because that's really what's done with most habitat surveys and most quantification of habitat. It's related to the gradient and other things over so many channel widths. And you'll see that in some of our recommendations for how people should be recommending. It's scalable to the channel size. That's one of the main things about using that upstream bank full width. So this gradient, the distance you measure the gradient over is going to depend on that bank full channel width. So in a bigger channel, it's going to be a longer distance you measured over. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
I do. I think at some point in your presentation, and one of the reasons we've got flip charts up here today is so that if we need to draw pictures, so the board understands what you're talking about, we can do that. But one of the things that I want you or somebody from the panel to explain is, what do you mean by an upstream threshold? What do you mean by a difference up and downstream? And you know, what's, you just talked about barriers, but we've got obstacles in the title of the graph. And so talk about, let's make sure that as we move forward in these 2 days, we're all talking about the same definitions.
So did you want me to take a minute to go through some of those definitions right now so that we're...
Can I ask a more basic question before we do that? Well, what if you ask this question about if you want him to do that now or later?
I don't want to necessarily disturb your flow, but...
What? Yeah, that was kind of you to call it flow because it's
So I mean at whatever point, but we need to get that clarified. Well, I see board member Nelson also has a question.
Go ahead, of course. I'll go first because this is the fourth or fifth time I've gone through this, and every time I go through it, I get more confused. So forgive the question, but when we gave you the direction last August, I thought you were going to supplement the data from the previous team, and we had already voted to go to the FHAM methodology and to use potential habitat breaks. There's only one between the west and the east side on here that actually looks at potential habitat breaks as something other than a threshold. Where did you come up with the idea to move to thresholds and why?
So the idea to use thresholds was always something that we had considered. And so there's two different, there's three different ways that people have looked at this. There's a threshold, so when you hit a certain gradient, the stream gets to be, you hit 10%, then that's a potential habitat break. There's a floor, which is like anything less than 10% is not a barrier, and then you can, you know, and then you could have some other criteria above that. And then there's a difference between the upstream and downstream. So one of the things that and we got this in talking, some of the panels had experience doing water types, water typing. And we also talked with folks who've done this a lot, and one of the things that they look for in the field is sometimes a change in the gradient, or it's a change in the width of the channel between the upstream and downstream. So that's why we basically looked at thresholds, which would be meeting a certain width or gradient. We looked at the differences upstream and downstream between gradient and channel width. And we also, in some cases, looked at the ratio between upstream and downstream channel widths or gradients.
I understand what thresholds are. My question is, a lot of us, or some of us anyway, were quite impressed with the original scientific report that you guys put forward. My understanding was you were going to augment that and you were going to flesh it out to a bigger geographical area to put more data in it and make it a more robust study. But that original study did not use all these different threshold measures. They were all based on different metrics towards it, the ratio up and down, up. These are all threshold measurements. I'm just wondering, when was that decision made and why?
In the previous report, you'll see that these test numbers are 4, 5, 2, 15, 16, 7, and 3. Those were all included in the original report in August. It's the same. Those are the same tests that were performed in August. We performed them in January with a different data set, with all those criteria, and we came up with different recommendations. But we were doing the exact same tests as what we did, and repeating the same analysis from what was done in the presentation.
So you weren't actually measuring to a potential habitat break, you were measuring to a threshold based on gradient or wooded stream or something else?
No.
That's what you're calling it?
It is a habitat break. We took the data from the habitat break. So if I had, if we had data on a concurred upon point that was, the upstream gradient was 20%, and the bank pull width was, say, 1.5 feet, then it would meet these criteria. So we didn't, I think the thing that's changed on this is that we put threshold, we didn't call them thresholds last time. We changed that terminology partly because some comments we got that people were a little bit confused by that, and there were some that were confused by the use of a ratio of upstream to downstream or a difference. So we were just trying to, that was simply some terminology to try and clarify. We didn't test any new criteria. These are the same ones that we had before. Just to your point about the data set, there are 180 points that are in our new data set that were in the original landowner data set that overlap. So we took points from the landowner data set for those two ecoregions we didn't have data. We had 70 points for each one of those. And then just our random sample in Western Washington came up with 46 points, I think, that were in the original landowner data set. I want to tell you that the science panel, after all the comments we got on the landowner data set, and the taking this random sample from the new data set, we were not comfortable with the original landowner data set from a number of reasons because of all the concerns about the data. And when we started doing this analysis, it was basically said, look, we've got a random sample data set that we feel comfortable with how the sample was drawn. We've got another data set that we're not comfortable how the data was drawn. So we weren't gonna put the two of them together. And that was a decision that we made because we felt it was the best to use the data that we were comfortable with and the random sample. It does include 180 something points from the original landowner data set.
Did you, from the water typing mod forms that you put into the second sample, did you use the same template that we asked you from the original study? I mean, that was my thought, was that you were going to use the same process, but it looks like two different processes here. That's what I'm trying to get at.
We used the same template. There is some information that was provided on the landowner data set after we had the first cut of it. There was some additional downstream widths that were added, but we have the same template. We also met with the stakeholders to get input on that.
So if you use the same template and there's two separate studies, one that has a partial of the sum of the landowner data, as you called it, then can you assess the accuracy of the two straight across the board using the same template?
When you say the accuracy, what do you mean?
I mean,
and I'm not trying to be Bill Clinton here saying what the meaning of is or not.
Yeah. I'm going to talk all morning without saying that. I've been watching Scandal or something. What I'm trying to get at is that we're looking for some sort of a recommendation or an assessment of the accuracy of different methodologies, and I just want to ensure that the original landowner data and the report that came forward is the same process, and therefore we can compare it to what you have the second report. Is there a way to do that, or am I asking something?
So we did, if you see that, the column, the reason that we kept this column in that shows what the original was found with the original landowner data set was partly to address that. Again, I think the challenge here from a scientific standpoint, if we have two data sets and you were trying to compare these different options to two data sets, and we're like, we have one we know was randomly drawn and we're comfortable with, and we have one we're not sure about and we're uncomfortable with, and we have, frankly, all kinds of criticisms not only within the panel but from others on it, we felt it was best to go with the one. There's a whole reason for drawing a random sample. It was a board motion, as Hans was bringing mine.
Yeah, I guess one of the things, not to belabor this, Board Member Nelson, but if you go back and look at the board motions from August, you know, we did ask the panel to do a geographically representative sample of the whole state because the original landowner data was focused in two areas. And there was no data from the east side, and there was only two ecoregions represented in that data set. And then second, we did ask them to do the comparison to make sure we had a sense of what we could do. And he's already talked about how they ended up, because they didn't have enough time to get two of the ecoregions filled out, they actually used the landowner data to fill out some of the blanks, if you will. Correct?
Yeah. So I think, am I continuing or am I answering more questions?
Why don't we go ahead and then let's come back and talk about that then, okay?
Yeah, sure. Okay, where was it? Okay, so we're talking about non-vertical obstacles. We had one recommendation that was the same both in Western Washington or statewide, and that's a 20%, this is for the non-vertical barriers, 20% elevation change over an obstacle length that is greater than the upstream bank bulkhead. And this is the same recommendation we had in August. Some mouse curls. Okay, so just to give you an example of what this looks like on the landscape. So if we're going up a stream, this is our drawing of the gradient of a stream, who we call a longitudinal profile going up the stream. And so we have a point where is a known fish point. So 6 feet wide, 2% gradient. Okay, so we move up till we hit a potential habitat break. Here's a point where the stream becomes, the gradient changes to 10%, still 6 foot wide, but it does meet the gradient criteria, so it's the potential habitat break. It's the initiation of a protocol survey, electrofishing, oh, we see a fish. So we move up to the next potential habitat break. The stream gradient here, it's not very clear, but it basically drops down and it's somewhere around 2%. But then it moves up again. We see another steep point where it reaches 10% gradient. That's a potential habitat break. Initiation of a protocol survey. Survey finds fish. Again, we move up. The channel with the channel gradient again is drops down below 10%. But then we get to a point where it reaches 10% gradient again. That's a potential habitat break, initiation of a protocol survey. No fish. Oh, we hit another barrier, a PHB, where there's an obstacle, no fish. So the FN break would be set back here at that, there we go.
The only thing that I would add here that I think is an important place of emphasis is this part, how you end the survey, that's going to be really important in the board manual to have clarification. You know, currently it's quarter of a mile of not finding fish, but this is a slightly different protocol, and so those details still have to be worked out. This is just taking the assumption that this distance you would go to at least the next PHB before you would default back. Could be greater than that, but the what the panel's recommending here is that at least you'd go to the next PHB just to ensure that there aren't fish between those PHBs. So this is an overly simplistic diagram, is the point.
More members for me.
So what would be the basis for changing the current practice of going a quarter mile beyond the last barrier?
With the FHAM, you can see that the assumption in the FHAM is that when you electrofish, you're looking for a fish within that PHB, not necessarily the last fish. Mm-hmm. Could be the first fish. It also could be coincident with the last fish. But it's within those, within this zone.
Right.
And so this is just the same zone. So it is a minimum to be consistent with the way that you apply the FHAM everywhere else. You'd want to go to the next PHB. Now, I wouldn't argue about the quarter of a mile, or there, we don't have any reason to say that that's wrong now. We also, you know, I mean, that's a decision that's clearly not for the panel so much. It's just developing criteria around these points.
Okay.
So it could be go to the next PHB, call it good, go to two PHBs, go to PHB or a quarter of a mile, whichever is longer. I mean, there's a million different ways that you could solve that problem, but that's not for the panel to decide. And I don't want to imply that this is the preferred method by the panel. This is just an illustration of how these thresholds would work. That's all.
Can I ask one more question? As long as I have a microphone. So in this example, you're just using grading.
Yes.
And as I look at the, you know, the table that has has combinations, right? There's test number four has a 10% gradient threshold, or, you know, and it's for a 2-foot width. And I remember getting a little wrapped around the axle on this in August as well. But why is it either or and not both? And if it's not both, why are there two things in, like in every test, there's two things that you only use one of them. So can you explain that? Can you indulge me and explain that again?
Yeah, so when we looked at, I think when we first, not people on the panel, I don't want to say it, but at least I know when we were first looking at this, I was thinking, oh, it's going to be, you know, it should be both, right?
Right.
When you start looking at the concurred upon points and the water type modification forms and the points, you realize rather quickly that most of these are only needing one. So one of those things could be a potential habitat rate. So it could be gradient, it could be width, sometimes it's both, or sometimes it's a barrier. And that's why we ended up, if I go back a bit, if you want to see the number of points, because it's going to take a while, that meet both, you can look in that gray area right there. I mean, I'm sorry, you can look in this little corner down here. If you look at existing concurred upon points, only that small, it's only like 20% for any of the criteria we tested. It's only a small number that meet both. Most of these FN breaks are occurring, and concurred upon points are occurring either based on gradient, width, or a barrier, not all three. Does that make sense?
That does make sense, but for every test you've got two. So does it mean that you might, like, so maybe you hit a 10% mm-hmm. threshold first,
mm-hmm.
And then the next thing you hit is 2 feet?
Yeah, we just, in this example, we were trying to, I mean, the challenge we have here is that we could go through, there's probably five likely scenarios, and I didn't want to, we knew we needed a slide to help explain this, and we also know that we sometimes are confusing people with these slides, so the last thing I wanted to do was put five of these in here. So these could be, so let me give you a different example. You could get to this point, and let's say the channel width, it's still 2% gradient, but the channel width comes down to 2 feet. Then it would be a PHP. Or it could be that there's a 3-foot vertical drop. I mean, there's a number of different.
I think one way to think about this that might be helpful is to think about it as a system. And so you're walking upstream, and you have your playbook, and you're looking for the changes. And so you might hit a change in size. I won't even say which one, just you'll hit a change of size. That might be a very logical place to do a survey and look and see if there's still fish there. The flip side is you might hit gradient. And so if you only had one or the other, you wouldn't necessarily have the complete playbook. And so the idea was, all right, if you're going to use 10% in your playbook, what are some other sizes? And I think we had another one of I guess it was 15 and 3 and some other, well, we had a number of different scenarios on our table, but the idea is that it's an entire system. It's the playbook together, not individual constituent parts. Like if you just picked gradient, for example, it would need some, you know, criteria in determining the points. A lot of the points, the FN breaks have been determined just with gradient. A number of them have been determined with size. And so the thought was giving deference to both of those being important.
So then just last clarifying, and thank you for your patience on this. So for each test, it means that you, in a system, you used both of these things, but not at the same time.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
Okay.
Oops. So just to kind of summarize, you know, so we based on the literature, you know, it was gradient width and barriers, and again, there were other things that we looked at, but it just wasn't supported in the literature, things like water quality or temperature or geomorphology. So those were the three basis for the system, as Hans might call it. We looked at a bunch of different scenarios, including fixed width or gradient or thresholds or ratios. The proposed ones we felt were the ones that are most consistent with the literature, our experience, and the understanding of how fish are reacting to the environment and these changes in gradient width and barriers. And so we feel that the analysis suggests that the proposed criteria perform better against the data set than the other options, or at least the ones we're recommending. So our recommendation, as you know, is to select from one of the top four performing set of pH Bay criteria for gradient bankfill width for Western Washington, one of the top two for Eastern Washington, and that for obstacles, it should be a vertical barrier of 3 feet, and for the non-vertical barriers, a 20% slope with that minimum elevation change of one upstream channel width. So a couple other recommendations. This question came up about what was some of the differences between the landowner data set and the new random sample, and one of those was that the landowner data set had a lot of information on downstream channel widths for tributaries. The challenge is that those channel widths are often a small stream flowing into a larger river, and if you used the downstream channel width, which would be, say, I have a small tributary to the Sole Duck River, I use the downstream channel width as a Sole Duck River that's 75 feet wide. The channel width of my tributary, the upstream channel width, is 3 feet. Well, right away, that triggers the tributary junction as a PHB. And so we think that the measurements that are collected in the field on this should be the downstream width for the lateral, or excuse me, for the tributary should be right at the junction, and then the upstream should be somewhere upstream, if that makes sense. The challenge we had with collecting data from the water type modification forms is that just there's not consistency in these protocols. So it's not clear whether they're recording bankfill width, channel width, or wetted width all the time. There's not a consistent protocol for measuring gradient, so sometimes the gradient could be over a long distance, it could be a short distance. So there really needs to be some consistent protocols, which I think is being addressed. You may have already started to address that, but that's a pretty clear thing we saw on looking at the data that we had. And that those changes in gradient and bankfill width really should be done over 20 times the average bankfill width. That's just a basic in geomorphology, or when we're designing studies to look at different riparian buffers or grazing effects of cattle or whatever, we're usually saying, okay, what's our study section? It's 20 times the bankfill width. It's a pretty standard for habitat surveys and for studies looking at habitat and fish use, and so that's what we think that the gradient and bankfill width measurements should be done over. Obviously, we're working on the validation study to validate these PHBs and see if there's some other criteria that might be able to be added. I did want to respond, and some of these questions came up. These are some common questions that we have been posed to us. And the first one is why do we have multiple recommendations? So one thing I want to you know, 10 or 15 years ago in the scientific literature, what you'd see is that we do an analysis on something, we do a multiple regression, and we come up with this model that fit the data the best. So you put forward, this is the one model. But what we realize, what people have realized, is that lots of times there's another model that is just about as good, and the data aren't perfect, so how do you know that one's much better? So what you see now is people present the top three or five candidate models because they're not necessarily statistically different. So that there's one reason that we thought it was good to present multiple recommendations. The other I talked about earlier, which is, what is the difference between a model that captures 92% and one that captures 91%? And we can't, they're not really statistically different. And then the final was, is that we had, you know, we wanted to give you some options, because while we feel that these are feasible to implement in the field, you have to make a policy decision, and we didn't want to paint you into a corner and say, oh, this is the only one, if we've got three or four that seem like they're really close. We also have received comments as, why are you proposing just one when two or three of these look similar? So why do the results, the other question that comes up is, why do these results look different from August? Well, we have, first of all, we had no data in Eastern Washington in August. We just had the Western Washington. And there are some differences in the landowner data set. And one of those I pointed out earlier, which is there's a lot more information on tributaries in the landowner data set, but it also has the downstream channel width, which is generally recorded in a larger stream, so that it automatically makes that use of a difference between upstream and downstream look a lot better. Another question is, okay, so why did you have consensus in August but not in this report? And we ended up having a lot of discussion with the panel about which ones we were going to recommend. And we basically took a vote on which ones to recommend, and it was like 8 out of 9 of us agreed with the recommendations for gradient and channel width for Eastern Washington and Western Washington. How does that differ from August? It actually doesn't really differ. It's just that we had one person in August that said, look, I'm not sure about your recommendations for Eastern Washington because we don't have a lot of data. But, you know, we're a panel, we've talked through this, and I'm, you know, if that's what everybody else thinks, I'm willing to agree to that as well. So it really isn't that our recommendation, that isn't so much different. And also I should point out that I've led a lot of science panels, and we always strive for consensus, but it's pretty rare particularly when you get, you know, 8 or 9 people with PhDs. It's pretty rare to get them to agree on something. So, you know, you strive for consensus, but often when you can't reach it, you just go with the majority vote. I should point out that this is it's not like we were split 4 to 5 or something like that. The other question that's come up is, what about using ratios or differences given the data we have on stream widths? And I think I kind of touched on that. The challenge we have, particularly for the tributary stuff, is just if you're going to use the ratios and you've got data from a downstream larger tributary, it's going to make that FM break right at the tributary junction. The other, I think, it starts to get to be complex to use in the field unless it's something really simple. The other challenge we had with the data is that a lot of the data are not continuous, particularly the bank full width data. So one of the things that we saw when we started looking at the data is that there's an awful lot of 2 foot wide streams and 3 foot wide streams and 4 foot wide streams. In other words, the data that they're just being binned. Somebody, they're in the field, they're either not measuring it or they're just rounding. So when you start to look at ratios on data that's not continuous, but it's been binned or it's ordinal, it statistically it creates a lot of problems. So that's the other challenge with using the ratios, at least with the data sets that we have. So that's an overview, and I think that obviously you have a lot of questions, so I'll stop there and we can get to your questions and maybe some of the definitions that you asked about.
Janicki, please.
Thank you for all the information, and some of my questions may seem primary. I wasn't at the August board meeting, so I may have missed some of the connecting points here. But, you know, as a, just a really fundamental question, with all the caveats that you've issued about the limitations of data, of information, I wouldn't even call it data, because it sounds like some of it's just extracted from narrative, but with the limitations that you've listed about the water type modification forms, how did you get comfortable using that as source data for some pretty important decision making? I mean, this has impact, and after 17 years of collecting information, if we don't have the right information, or do I have the right information to actually make a rule from it? I mean, yeah. Get me comfortable about what is in those 700 forms that said yes. And she said yes.
So that's a good question. I mean, I think that a couple of things is that, one, I want to say we, in talking to some of the folks that have done, that do thousands of these surveys, literally yearly, these are the things, the criteria that it comes down to are the size of the channel. I mean, it's basically flow and gradient and barriers. We can't get estimates of flow for all these small streams. They don't exist. And so channel width is used as a surrogate for that, and that's what they do in the field. So we know those are the three things. The other thing is this data set is concurred upon points. So these are data where they define the potential habitat break and the FM break based on points that was agreed upon by the different stakeholders and agencies. And so we have met, and these are the forms that we had that had data reported. So that's why we had such a, it's a random sample, but it, there are some biases in it because it's the only ones that had good data in it. So I think that what our feeling was is that, and maybe there's nine of us, so maybe I'll just say my feeling was, I feel a little more comfortable with that because I probably met, maybe a cup or something like in the back as I'm saying we. I think that I was comfortable using this to test the criteria because these are concurred upon points, they're measurements from the field, and they were from the only data that we have that are, they're the key pieces of information we need. So I think that those data from those forms are good, and we limited it to just three things. So from my standpoint, it's a reasonable thing to use to test the different criteria because it's actually what happened in the field and what was measured in the field.
So one of those ecoregions was Blue Mountain that only had one yes. And so is it scientifically supportable to extrapolate the other 702 data points and apply it to a region? I guess there's so many points when you walk out in the woods that I'm trying to figure out if I'm making a rule based on 700 data, is 700 enough? Is there a bias when you only have one out of that?
Well, so I think it's an issue if we were trying to make ecoregion specific. That's what we would like to have done, but that's why we rolled these up by Eastern versus Western Washington. So I wouldn't be comfortable extrapolating to, from one data point to a bunch of other data points. From 700, I'm more comfortable with. I think that the other thing to keep in mind is that we did some estimates of the variability in the data to figure out how many samples we would need to be able to look at ecoregion differences. This is why we had a target sample size of 50 to 75 for each ecoregion. The other point I want to say is that, look, part of the reason that we're talking about a validation study is because the data that we, the data that we really like to have is a continuous survey. If you remember this wonderful drawing, if you look at that line up the stream, What we're talking about doing in the validation or the study is to get points all along, to survey that whole line above and below wherever that end of fish point is, so that rather than have someone go out there and make that determination and say where this is. We can look at all the data and look at several hundred points with these data and determine where, what you know, which of these criteria or what would work across the landscape, and not based on whether somebody made a determination, but based on the actual physical data and what the fish did. So part of this is the need, if you want really good data, we're gonna have to do the follow-up study. These were the best data we had, and we feel comfortable using them to test the different scenarios to make a recommendation. But our assumption has been there's gonna be a validation study to get really the information, really detailed information to validate those and to perhaps make some corrections to it if there's some other factors that we didn't include besides gradient and width and variance.
So here's one of those issues, and maybe it's because I was absent, and the whole time I read the words validation study, I always thought that meant somehow confirming the data set that was brought forward from industry. So validation, I thought, meant an affirmation of data that was submitted. So it's a good thing you use that in a whole sentence, because...
I don't know if the validation, it would be to... The reality is, it will validate any criteria. We're going to do, the idea is to do a study that could validate any criteria that was chosen. So it's not going to be dependent on whether you chose the first or the second one. It's going to be able to, it'll be able to validate those criteria, but it'll be able to detest any other criteria and see if there's other factors as well, if it's done right.
One more question.
I want to follow up on that real, in 2 seconds, 5 seconds.
The purpose of the adaptive management program is to determine if and when it's necessary to adjust forest practice rules. And so what we're doing up front with this one is whatever the PHB criteria are, we're going to be in a position to assess whether or not they are the correct criteria to use. So I don't want to say that whatever the criteria are, that we're necessarily going to change those or not change those. We're going to go into it with an open mind and do that evaluation of the rule, whatever that looks like.
2 seasons? You're going to do it in 2 seasons?
The panel, the thinking now is not to be able to do it in 2 seasons.
So just to thank you for that clarification. So the adaptive management process has always been intended to do one of 2 things. One is, you know, at some point the board or through the forest and fish negotiations, we pick some targets. And to validate those targets, this will be just another one of those processes where we're gonna have to make the difficult decision to pick a target to move forward, and then CMER and along with the panel will help us validate that data down the road. Board member Nelson.
2 questions. I'm still going back to the data here. I think you could have used a better diagram of that up there. I know that that's to serve your purposes, but there's a 5-foot width with a 10% gradient and then a 4-foot width with a 10% gradient. I defy all of us in this room to go out and find that same point on the ground, personally. But my real question is, well, actually I've got 2 questions. One, the original landowner data took end of fish, and then they measured a bunch of parameters up and down the stream as to where the end of habitat was set. I mean, there's kind of a misperception that the nose of the last fish is where the FN break is being set, and that's not the case in practice. In practice, an ID team will set end of habitat somewhere above where that end of fish is. I've been on a lot of these, and I know that for a fact. The landowner data took the end of fish, measured up to where that end of habitat was, tried to define what kind of a potential habitat break was there, and assess the accuracy of was there a consistent trend in that value. When you took the water typing mods to expand this study, did you have end of fish in all cases that you could do the same thing and measure up from it? Or were you using as a starting point where the ID team set that water type mod? It's a big difference.
No, we did not have end of fish. I think there was
it was less than 100 forms that had the end of fish. So that's not something that's routinely recorded on all the forms.
Right, I understand that.
But the points are, we realize that we're trying to define the potential habitat breaks. Having the end of fish would be useful, but it's not necessarily key for defining the potential habitat breaks and where they're going to be put on the landscape.
But if you know where the end of fish is, you know where the end of fish is. If you're just trying to find some parameters and say that they're out there and use some sort of a physical description of it, you don't know how far up from the end of fish. I'm getting to the next step of this, which is going to be tomorrow. How do we assess the costs and benefits to all this? And so I'm trying to determine how you came about all of the parameters you measured. I know how they were done with the landowner data, because you had an end of fish point on the ground. And so you can measure up from that, and you can figure out how much distance is now going to have a fish buffer on it. But I'm not sure how you're going to quantify that for us to make a decision on cost and benefit without knowing where the fish is.
We weren't asked to do a cost benefit analysis, and we weren't asked to determine what your request is. So I don't know if that's a rhetorical question or you just...
No, I'm trying to figure out why you didn't use that fish in here. And I know you're not supposed to do the cost benefit analysis, but we have to have that. So
very quickly, I understand what you're asking in terms of the fish and then whatever that distance is, because there is a cost there. That's a calculation that can be readily had. I completely understand why that would be necessary for the cost benefit analysis. I'm not going to argue that point at all. The point about how the fish point is used in determining the break, it would have been nice to have that fish point. I think it's helpful for context, but we didn't use a distance, a fixed distance above the fish for whatever that break would be. So therefore, what we ended up with was focusing on, well, what was it? What was the feature that was used ultimately with the last fish information going into the decision? Because we only use protocol surveys, how was that used? Is it the same thing? No, it's not the same thing. But I don't know that it's a large leap to say that it was somehow wrong because we used information that was based on the last fish to determine what the break itself was, because that's what we were focused on, was the break. I don't think it's a complete picture. I think it's better with the fish. I agree with you. But I don't think it's necessarily a fatal flaw in coming up with what the triangles are.
No, I didn't mean to imply that. I'm just curious why you didn't use end of fish and you didn't have the data in the second set. That's the answer. My last question, I have to be brief, is you said that 8 out of 9 agreed with this. What were the objections of the 9th person?
So can I suggest this? We're going to bring up the whole panel after public comment.
I didn't know that.
And maybe we can provide, let that person talk about to that personally. I think that might be a better way. The other thing is, I what I'm hearing from Hans and Phil is that end of fish was not, what we asked them to do is identify potential habitat breaks, of which end of fish, I think we don't want to confuse the need, potential need for end of fish to do an economic analysis, which these guys won't be doing. That'll be something the staff is doing once we make a decision and go forward on some metrics. But I don't want to confuse that. What I've heard is they didn't need end of fish to identify some metrics for potential habitat. Member Davis.
Since you have this diagram up here, I have a question. I've been looking at the table 4 with the various tests, and I'm wondering if the 5% increase, that inflection point in channel gradient alone, is sufficient to identify or to really impede fish access, or if you're if the reach is under 10%, for example, when you're going from 2 to 7%, is that enough, or is it really when you're looking from 10 and above? So
don't know if I've got that. I'm just wondering about how this, the 5% inflection, regardless of the baseline gradient. I'm just trying to understand if you're looking below 10%, if the, especially when you're looking at, for example, number 9, your test number 9, and the different changes in gradients, there we have that 5% there, and I'm just wondering if 5% alone is good enough to say some kind of impediment to fish, or if we're looking at that at just above the 10%. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just going to rephrase your question.
Okay, thank you.
So your question is it 5%, is a 5% gradient enough, alone enough to impede fish, or is it a 5% change above from 10% to say 15?
Yes.
And you're specifically referring to test number 9, which is a more complicated one.
Well,
so
if you look at the 5% inflection, how does that compare to what you assessed here in test number 9?
Just a second.
I just wanted to be clear.
No, we had, well, so I think one of these tests is a test that we were, was a, you know, a combination of things, which was a floor of every, you know, it had to be at least 5% and then a 10% change. I've got to, I got to ask one of the panel members a quick question before I can respond to that.
Okay.
Board Member Davies, can you tell us what page that's on?
Oh, it's on page 33. It's the second page of table 4, which starts on page 32. I was just, yeah, it's the gradient column, gradient threshold column, which is number 9.
Sorry, this was one of the more, this was one of them where we split it based on based on the gradient downstream. So if it was,
that's,
sorry, just a second.
Right, so what this is this is setting a, what we would determine to be a floor. So the idea is that there wouldn't be any looking for, oh no, I'm sorry, excuse me. So if it's, this is saying that if the gradient is less than 10%, that you would need a 10% change in order to look above it, or it would be only a 5% change if the gradient were 10% or greater. So that's establishing a different, it's two scenarios. If the gradient's from 0 to 10%,
you need
a 10% change. So if you found fish at 2, you'd have to go to 12. Once you went to 12, you'd only have to go to 17 for that change of that value, right? Because the gradient would be then above 10, and so the next change would only need to be 5 to look.
And so that 5% change above 10% alone is impediment to fish.
Yes. It's a pH. It's a potential.
It's a potential habitat, right?
Right.
It's the starting point for a protocol like fishing.
Think of it this way. With the data set for where the FN breaks were determined that we were using, that was a good indicator of that point. It was a good indicator, it was coincident with points where that was the determination for end of fish habitat, that change of 5. That's why you'll see the change of 5 fits in a lot of different places. It also fit in pretty well without the specificity of the 10%, which you'll also see it in the same table as having a higher degree of consistency with the end result. So yes, the 5% change above 10%, below 10% in both cases, was a pretty strong indicator in the tests that we ran, no doubt about it.
Okay. Are we going to get to definitions? Because I did want to ask about the obstacle, and when you call something an obstacle, are we talking about permanent, natural, non-deformable? Is that all within the definition of an obstacle?
Can I just for that, or do you?
Well, let me just the obstacle thing.
Okay.
I mean, the reality is that they've always been called barriers,
okay.
Right?
Right.
And so both within the panel, and we received extensive comments that were like, you shouldn't be calling these barriers. These should be called obstacles. And so, and the literature's kind of going the same way. So it was somewhat of an attempt to move away from using a barrier, because many of these are obstacles to fish passage.
And they might get
it. Yeah, under okay. certain. And,
you know, and they're not absolute.
Right.
There, WDFW, for example, does have criteria what an absolute barrier is. These were not intended to be absolute barriers. The word potential habitat break is really key in this whole thing.
Right.
They could be coincident, and they may not be coincident. And it has. And one of the challenges here in this entire process, I can't overstate this, is you have a tension between having enough of a change in the character of the stream, either by a threshold at 10% it changes, or by having a change in gradient from one point to another, whatever that is, you have to have enough explanation to make a determination, okay, that is a logical place to start. That's a good place to start to look for fish. But at the reality is, you don't want to overshoot that too far by having some criteria that is too stringent and is really ultimately only used as an end of fish. It has to work for the beginning, and then it also has to accommodate the end. And so there's this tension between having enough of a change that it warrants looking, but not so much of a change that it is, in fact, the end point of the permanent natural barrier as one extreme. It has to fit for both of those pieces within the FHAM proposal.
So can I put just make really explicit what that means, what you just said, and I'll test this out and you tell me if I'm right. So, and I think it's kind of the basic tension for all, the whole policy decision that we have to make, because on the one hand, if that point, if the PHB is too low, essentially, or too easy to get over, then you risk, or we risk having a rule that could have electrofishing that can result in a false negative. And we're, on the one hand, we're trying to avoid that. On the other hand, we don't want it too far up. So there's a distance between where, you know, the truth is of the end of actual habitat and where you start looking for fish so the landowners don't have to protect more habitat than is actually on the ground. And the thing that we're struggling with is that you guys did the best you could with the amount of data that you had to give us some options of what those points look like. But in the absence of the validation study, we don't have the information. And so we're swimming around in this uncertainty of trying to make sure that we do our jobs and protect fish habitat like the rule says. The rule says we have to protect fish habitat for all life stages for all times of the year, right? You know, but obviously we also have a charge of not unduly burdening the timber industry by protecting stuff that actually isn't fish habitat. Is that it? Is that where we are?
That's where we are.
Just
I have another question. Board member Nelson. To me, there's four different options for the west side and two for the east side, all of which seek to put some sort of numeric threshold on where end of fish habitat is. That would be the PHB, at which point we would start a protocol survey to validate whether or not there are fish in the stream, right? Am I to assume that if you start at that PHP under any of these scenarios and you don't find fish, you turn around and you go downstream to look for it as well?
Yeah, I would assume that.
Because it's not clear here that that would be your intent.
That gets into the details around the FM and the protocol survey and what you would do in that case. My assumption, and this is separate from the participation in the panel, it's more the discussions at policy. The FM relies on fish presence to true up where you draw the boundary. So my assumption is that it could go up or down.
Right.
That's your idea.
Thank you.
Here's what I would suggest if there are no pressing questions. Okay, board member Davies. Because you're going to get a second shot at this.
Okay. Well, I wanted to, you mentioned some criteria that WFW has set, and I wondered if you could talk about the criteria that you landed on around the 3 feet vertical, and regardless of width. And I just wonder if, because I'm just thinking through, you know, stream changes width, and if it's a wider stream, it's a little different than if it's a narrower stream. So can you talk to us about how you landed on that 3 feet?
Yeah, so the 3 feet was based on, and I think we did, I think we covered, did a summary of what the literature says on fish jumping performance, and we looked at the jumping, we looked at fish size, and we even did a little bit of modeling to see what that was. And so one thing I wanted to point out, and I thought I mentioned this, was, and these are looking at headwater streams. So a 3 foot, because the thing that comes up often is, oh, a 3 foot barrier, well, a steelhead, an adult steelhead can jump 16 feet, and, you know, to jump a barrier 16 feet. So it's like, well, how does 3 feet work? So, well, 3 feet in a small stream for a juvenile salmonid or another fish that's 6 to 10 inches, 3 feet is a barrier based on what we saw. So that's how we arrived at that. The other non-vertical barrier was scale to channel. So I'm not sure I answered your question, but I think I'm just, I thought you asked how did we come up with 3 feet,
yep,
and wouldn't that be different in a bigger stream?
Right. So you're saying that it's different for different
stages? Obstacle versus barrier.
Excuse me, there are a couple of things. One is, I don't think that's supposed to be up on the screen. So let's take that down. And then second, Board Member Davis wants to clarify.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask, in our protocol, an obstacle or a barrier includes the depth of the plunge pool below. And so was that part of your assessment in the 3 feet? Because that's really critical in how they use the current in the plunge pool to vault them, which goes beyond swim speed.
There's also some studies that have been done on trout, resident trout, and they've looked at the jumping performance without a plunge pool, without a depth. Because, yeah, most of the studies, and a lot of the studies are older that have been done, the classic studies that have been done on fish leaping performance have all pointed to a plunge pool being important, particularly for adult salmon and steelhead. So that was something that was we talked about, but again, in these a lot of these are small headwater streams, and you know, we weren't going to get into having people measuring a plunge pool, and some of the studies have shown that this fish can still, some trout, brook trout and cutthroat can still jump fairly high, well, a couple feet without a plunge pool. I think if you have more specific, what I might say after Hans chimes in is that Pat Trotter and Pete Disson, the two members on the panel, looked into this quite extensively. And I think rather than me summarize what their findings were, it would be good to let them respond to that. And I don't know if you really want to do that later.
Yeah, let's do that later. So here's my suggestion is we're past our break time and we're running late. And so what I'd like to suggest is we take a 15-minute break. We come back, do public comment, I'm assuming public comment will generate more questions from the board members to the panel, and we'll bring the whole panel up for that part of the discussion, okay? Is that okay with that? All right.